Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. It was 1965 when Congress finally responded to the tragic images of our elders eating dog food after being bankrupted by health care they couldn't pay for and dying prematurely from illnesses they couldn't afford to treat. The action Congress took was to create Medicare, our largest entitlement program that aimed to ensure that seniors and the disabled had access to health care. But over the years, it's also become an entitlement program for a health care industry and corporate interests that have spiraled out of control and threaten the intent and very existence of the Medicare program. This situation is laid out in the new book, Medicare Meltdown: How Wall Street and Washington Are Ruining Medicare and How to Fix It. The book is by Rosemary Gibson and Janardan Prasad Singh, and they describe in disturbing detail how these corporate interests and the healthcare system itself are undermining this important healthcare benefit. I'm very pleased to have back on Health Styles Rosemary Gibson, the lead co-author on this book. Rosemary, thank you so much for joining me again on Health Styles.
Diana, I'm really delighted we're having this conversation today.
And I might just say that Rosemary has been on before because of her other books, one of which is The Treatment Trap, that lays out how we are overscreening and overtreating in this country. And if you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. So let me start, Rosemary, by saying that as you read the book, it's clear that we all should have this sense of urgency about the future of Medicare. Why?
Well, Diana, policymakers in Washington, D.C., both Democrats and Republicans, including in the White House as well as Congress, are talking about raising the Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 67, and which would be a tragedy for older adults in the United States. And that will just be the first of many cutbacks in the program that could take place if we are not vigilant and preserve Medicare for older adults in this country. This is a very real challenge that we face. The other urgency comes from how much older adults now are paying for health care, which is often hidden. A lot of people think Medicare is free. Medicare is not free once you reach age 65, and the cost of that is going up and up and up. So there's tremendous urgency, and I think we don't hear much about it in the media because the White House doesn't want to alarm seniors because they think, well, the Republicans will blame it on health care reform, and the Republicans don't want to tell the truth. So I wrote this book, Medicare Meltdown, to tell the truth, create the urgency, and a pathway for the public to speak out.
So, and actually, that was a surprise to me. I hadn't really thought about the extent to which Medicare Part B, which is paying for home care physician services, is actually deducted from your Social Security check, and that continues to go up.
Exactly. I was shocked myself. So the Medicare Trustees Report, which is a very complicated report, I looked at it one day. And let's take the average person's Social Security check. If you're not yet 65, but expect that you're going to take home your entire Social Security check, that's not going to be because Medicare Part B is deducted from your Social Security check. Also, you'll have to pay Part D for prescription drugs. So how much does this all add up to be? Well, in 2011, if an average person retired, again, this is on average, 27% of the average person's Social Security check is going to pay just for Medicare Part B and Part D. When Medicare was started in the late 60s, it was only about 6 to 7%. By 2035, when I'm in my 80s, it's going to be up to 40%. And there is nothing to stop it. And that's why comedian George Carlin said, "They're coming for your Social Security." Well, the healthcare industry has found a way to take people's Social Security money. This is why people should really be alarmed.
And let's also point out that that we are all paying into Medicare as we work.
Yes. So everybody who's working, you have an amount deducted from your paycheck for Medicare Part A, which pays for hospital care. But when you are on Medicare, you won't pay for hospital care. You will pay for physician services under Part B and prescription drugs under Part D.
And Rosemary, you mentioned that both Democrats and Republicans are considering raising the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 67. Why are they looking for ways to withdraw Medicare from, or scale back Medicare from people who really are eligible?
Why? Because I think they don't have the guts, because they've been captured by the healthcare industry that wants to put the onus on the American people to take more of the public's money. Here's a quick anecdote that really crystallized it for me. One night I was watching the local news, and there was an advertisement on television from the American Hospital Association. This was during the debates on the fiscal cliff. And in this ad, the hospitals were encouraging seniors to call their member of Congress and to tell them they should not cut hospital payments because that will hurt seniors. And meanwhile, I later found out, what were the hospitals doing up on Capitol Hill talking to their members of Congress about? They were urging Congress to raise the Medicare eligibility age, not to cut hospitals.
Really?
Yes.
That's tough.
So the industry was really wanting seniors' help, but on the other hand was ready to throw them under the bus. This is the reality that the public needs to know.
And we have a healthcare system that is out of control in terms of spending on high technology, in terms of emphasis on acute care, and not enough emphasis on how to promote the health of a population.
That's exactly right. We are spending so much on healthcare. And the question is, are we making people healthier? Enable older adults and people of all ages to actually live a healthier life? We only do things in healthcare if we get paid. And so we're only doing the things that they can get paid for. And nobody's paying for health. We're only paying for lots and lots and lots of health care, every surgery known to humankind, every test. But that our health outcomes as a country certainly don't show that more money is getting us more health.
And Rosemary, part of this problem, I think, is that the industry and our society have sold the American public on more health care is better, that you want the most that you can get. And if you go into a provider and the provider says, well, I don't know that we need to do that or do this, you start to get skeptical. And in fact, as a nurse, I know that when people are critically ill, when they are terminally ill, it's not unusual for family members to come into an intensive care unit, even though this person is going to die, and say, we want you to do everything possible, without realizing what that means in terms of suffering and what you subject that person to. This idea that more is better plays into this, doesn't it?
Well, there's different folks out there who have different situations. For people who are uninsured and don't have access, more could very well be better. Okay. And then you have people who do have insurance and really good insurance, and that's where less could be more. And you're right about for patients with serious illness nearing the end of their lives, that the amount of things that are being done to them without evidence that they'll actually get better is so extraordinary. I talk to doctors and I talk to nurses who work in the intensive care units with older adults, and the amount of moral distress that they feel about doing things to older adults that they know will not help them, but which is causing them physical suffering, mm-hmm. and no doubt emotional and spiritual suffering, is off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the public thinks that more is better because they don't really know. What's it like for your mom or your dad to be on a ventilator or to have a feeding tube mm-hmm. continuously and knowing that there's no indication at all that that will improve the quality of your life or really extend your life? And we're not having honest conversations
yeah.
with them
yeah.
to tell them the truth so they can make an informed decision that's good for them. The question I love is, what's important to you right now? And maybe it's getting off that ventilator so they can say goodbye, say I love you,
mm-hmm.
and embrace.
And so this whole idea of how to fix Medicare, part of, I would argue, the part of it is our awareness of what is contributing to the meltdown of Medicare and how we play into it. But there are the broader issues, bigger issues here, and the more important issues of the healthcare industry itself and corporate interests that now think they are entitled, as you laid out with the American Hospital Association, how it was had its own interests put, it was lobbying for its own interests before that of seniors. And so talk a little bit about, you have in the book, The Seven Habits of an Entitled Healthcare Industry, and that healthcare industry, and you have some very rich examples of this entitlement. So take us through a couple of these seven habits of an entitled healthcare industry that are contributing to waste and the rising cost of Medicare that we're all now starting to pay for.
Here's a great story told me about a hospital by a wonderful physician. He's a surgeon, and he wanted to be a good steward of resources. So he asked his financial office to go with him to find out how much all the supplies in his operating room actually cost, because he never knew. And he found out that there were $700,000 worth of supplies just in his operating room. They also found that 10% of those supplies had expired and had to be thrown out. One OR, $70,000. He also found out that he only needed about $300,000 worth, less than half of what was in there. So he was horrified, and he went to his hospital CEO and said, I found a way for our hospital to save millions of dollars over the course of several years across all of our operating rooms. And he thought that this would be met with open arms. What a great thing to do. And by the way, the same physician wanted to buy a piece of ultrasound equipment, found it online for a certain price, and the hospital was going to pay 10 times as much. And he was told that, no, he has to buy it through the hospital. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. It's the market for how hospitals purchase equipment and supplies. Mm-hmm. And to be blunt and to the chase, as I write about Medicare meltdown, it's corrupt. And when Republicans call for competition and transparency on prices, this is where we should have competition and price transparency at this wholesale level. It's a $200 billion market. It's a shadowy market. And it's a monopoly, and all sorts of practices go on. And all of this increases the cost for us, whether it's private insurance or Medicare. So this physician who wanted to be a good steward hit what I call the brick ceiling. And he was in deep distress about it. This is where the big money is, but we never hear about it. So when Democrats or Republicans want to cut Medicare, or at least to preserve it for future generations, don't cut the eligibility. Cut this $200 billion market to have real efficiency. Mm-hmm. That's what we should be doing, and we'll have better care for patients.
So there's another, the other issue that you raise in the book has to do with competition, and that we hear, particularly from the Republican side, that we need more competition in healthcare. And yet, when we all know that healthcare is not really a free market, that it's not like you're going to shop around for the best deal when you are having chest pain. You're going to go to the closest emergency room. But you have a stunning example in the book of how even when somebody tries to bring down the costs of medications for a community, that it is a dangerous thing to try to do. This is the mayor, former mayor of Springfield, Massachusetts.
Yes, Diana, I had the privilege of interviewing a gentleman who was formerly a mayor of Springfield, Massachusetts, and he wanted to be a good steward of his community's resources. Like in many towns and cities around the country, they're under fiscal pressure. And this actually happened a number of years ago. And, you know, he didn't want to lay off firefighters and policemen, but their health care spending was going up and up and up. And so he had the brilliant idea of, well, why don't we buy our prescription drugs for people in who work for the city and their families and retirees and go to Canada where we can get them cheaper. And so they started doing that as a pilot test for a small number of their employees by mail order. It's perfectly legal. And they did it, and they were saving lots and lots of money. And, of course, the families were very happy. But then one day he got a phone call from the U.S. Department of Justice and urging him that he should stop doing that. And he said, well, there was nothing illegal about it. It was perfectly fine. And the next day he held a press conference in his community to let everybody know, to put them on notice so he wouldn't be out there all by himself, saying this is what happened. And then he called the head of the FDA at the time and said, what's this? And who said, oh, it just must be a coincidence. Well, this mayor said that later on his own son's insulin was intercepted from Canada to the United States by the U.S. Postal Service. And he knew that, and it was perfectly legal, he knew that people were watching him very closely. And I asked him if he decided to run for mayor again for another term, and he said no. And I said, why? He said, because I know these forces are very powerful. And they'd find something on me. And he said, I worked in law enforcement, and someday they'll put me behind bars. Mm-hmm. And what happened with this prescription drug purchasing program, and by the way, the pharmaceutical companies threatened to stop supplying the Canadian pharmacies that have been selling prescription drugs to Americans. Mm-hmm. So they used their, shall we say, pressure in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this prescription drug buying plan was washed away when the state took over the health plans of towns and cities around the state. So while certain forces may say, let's have competition, they really don't want competition.
Yeah.
And by the way, this mayor, he appeared on 60 Minutes, and he said that he had gotten proposals from countries around the world saying, if you put out a call for proposals from the city of Springfield for prescription drugs, we will respond. Mm. We'll provide you high-quality, low-cost drugs. Mm. From Israel, perhaps a whole bunch of countries offered to do that. And, of course, he wouldn't be allowed to do it. Mm. That's real competition. Mm. Mm. So it's just rhetoric.
Yeah.
I also just wanted you to touch on two other examples that you have in the book about the healthcare industry and corporate interests, one being the hospice industry and the other being the device industry. Can you give just a brief example of each about how they're contributing to the rising costs of Medicare?
Well, as you know, Diana, hospice care in the United States was started by a wonderful nurse, mm-hmm. the former dean of the Yale School of Nursing, Florence Wald, a great, great, great mm-hmm. person. She's actually in the Women's Hall of Fame, National Women's Hall of Fame in the United States. And she started hospice as a voluntary effort in the probably late 60s, 1970s. And she advocated for Medicare coverage of hospice, which Congress did do, which was mm-hmm. a good thing in the early 1980s. And in just less than 25 years, half of all hospices now have become for-profit. There's nothing inherently wrong with being for-profit. But there has to be in the marketplace some assurance that people are participating in the market appropriately. It's been very interesting to watch how many hospices, including for-profits, have been investigated by the Department of Justice for enrolling people who are not dying. Mm-hmm. And they looked at internal emails during their investigation, how non-clinical people would deliberately want to keep people in for another month and another month, even when the nurses and physicians said that they don't need to be here. Mm-hmm. They can go home. These are not cases, as we've seen in some hospice, where mm-hmm. people who really are sick and it's hard to know how long they're going to yeah. live. These are people who can go home.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing now private equity firms buy hospices. And some of these are run by former bankers. And so what's happening is the money that people are paying from their paychecks today, some of that money, hospice is covered under that Part A, some of that money is being used to pay for lawyers hired by hospices to defend the indefensible. Mm-hmm. And many of them have had to pay back huge settlements. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing to stop it. No. They can keep, it's like whack-a-mole. You can keep doing it and doing it and doing it.
And they're driving out some of the not-for-profit hospices because they're skimming off the healthiest, if you will, off the top, and as soon as the person uses up a certain amount of services, if they are terminally ill, they're dumping them into the nonprofits, and they're going to require more care from the nonprofits, and the nonprofits have really been struggling.
Yeah, nonprofits are struggling when they have for-profit competitors out there. It's really a challenge.
So we're going to hold on the example of the device manufacturers, but I want to encourage listeners to get a copy of this book. I'm talking to Rosemary Gibson and about her new book, The Medicare Meltdown, How Wall Street and Washington Are Ruining Medicare and How to Fix It, published by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. And so that we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to, and I encourage readers to get this book and read it. It's a stunning and very disturbing account of what is going on in our country around Medicare and how we should not put up with having the making Medicare solvent be on the backs of the people it's supposed to benefit.
The line I use, Diana, is seniors' entitlement to Medicare is not what's pushing it over the fiscal cliff. And there really are serious long-term financial issues with Medicare, no mistake.
Yeah.
The real problem is the healthcare industry's sense of entitlement to Medicare's money. That's the problem.
So what do we do about it?
Well, I think the public needs to know where their money is going, who's getting it, and how they're using it. First off the bat, because we don't know. We give so much of our money over our lifetimes for Medicare. And so that's the first step, to be informed. And we're not going to hear about this in the mainstream media. And so we have to be informed to participate in our democracy, not by remote, but we have to be informed and set up a countervailing influence. So I see the solution as more democracy of informed citizens that says, cut this, not that.
What about the issue of each of those who are receiving Medicare asking to see a copy of the bill, asking, why do I need this service, asking tougher questions?
Yeah, very practical things. If you're told that you need a test or a surgery or a procedure, and it's not an urgent situation, find out why. Do you need it now or can it wait? What are alternatives that are less intensive and less costly? What are the risks and benefits? Because overuse is so pronounced. Back surgeries, people on Medicare getting back surgeries who never should get them, and what's happening is causing higher complications and higher mortality. So if you need it, get it. If you don't need it, don't. And frankly, on drugs, so many drugs that seniors are taking, go home and go on your computer and Google it. Know what you're taking. Go to the Mayo Clinic website. Go to the NIH, National Institutes of Health website, and find out what drug you're taking. To look at interactions. You have to do your homework.
I just want to share that I have a friend who has been on Medicare but didn't tell her physician, her primary care physician, that she was on Medicare. And she's really into, I don't want much done. She has a chronic health problem that she manages herself pretty well. The office found out that she was on Medicare. He immediately ordered a stress test and ordered all these other tests for her to go through when they really were unnecessary. She felt intimidated. She felt, what I need him for, I'm not going to get if I alienate him. So it is asking the question of, why do I need this? And feeling that you have the authority to say, no, I don't want that test.
Right.
Right.
And a big challenge is there, a lot of physicians are not taking Medicare.
Yeah.
And so if you're 64 and very happy with your physician, don't assume that he or she will also be your doctor when you're on Medicare.
Yeah. Good. Well, I want to thank you very much. Your book is quite enlightening. It is very disturbing. The examples are so rich, though, that you cannot deny the arguments. They are very rich, and I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's a really important work, Rosemary.
Well, thank you, Diana. We all have a stake in Medicare's future, yeah. And we have to be part of the solution.
We've been talking with Rosemary Gibson, the author, co-author of Medicare Meltdown. The subtitle of this book is How Wall Street and Washington Are Ruining Medicare and How to Fix It. It's published by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. I strongly encourage you to get a copy of this book and to, for people of all ages, those of us who are not yet retired and on Medicare need to understand what we're paying into and what we need to do to make sure that Medicare is there for when we need it in our future. I do not want to be eating dog food as our foremothers did before Medicare because they couldn't afford the health care that they had and were bankrupted by it. So it's a serious issue, and I hope all of our listeners will get a copy of this book and read it. And I want to thank you for listening. You've been listening to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thanks for tuning in.